Thank you all for joining us on this panel. And the panel is on fostering autonomy in surgical trainees. As you all know, we all agree that autonomy is a critical component of surgical training. After all, our ultimate goal is to prepare young surgeons to go out, take care of patients, and perform operations independently. But it isn't as easy as it's said. The task of doing this has been made even more challenging because of many factors that are part of a changing landscape, may it be duty hour regulations, increasing regulatory and liability concerns, the changing demands on the faculty time, as well as the evolving patient experience. And we will touch on that patient experience later, where we have a project on patient education. So as educators, we struggle to try to find a balance of, I guess, turn this on, of instilling autonomy and supervision. Is it possible for really for both to coexist in a training paradigm? Hopefully we can get some answers. How about the effect of autonomy of the trainees on patient safety and eventually the quality of care that we give our patients? These are dilemmas we face. And as part of the Committee on Resident Education of the American College of Surgeons, we have decided to prioritize this and make this really front and center of our activities, or at least one of major activities that we are currently working on. And to share with you, this is a project that we started about a year ago, and one of the things we did is come up with a mission statement, and it goes such as, in the development of a surgical resident, progressive mentored independence is essential for the safety of surgical patients, now and in the future. The mission of this project is to provide faculty and trainees the framework to achieve the appropriate balance between supervision and autonomy in surgical residency. So with this in mind, our different work groups have gone on to develop strategies to enhance autonomy and incorporate it into our surgical training. For the panel this morning, we have four stakeholders. Unfortunately, Dr. Combs couldn't join us due to unforeseen circumstances, but Dr. Sachdeva will share with us some of the findings from the ACGME. So our first speaker to really introduce the whole topic is probably the one who pioneered the idea of this in our committee, and he needs no introduction. It's Dr. Sachdeva.
Could you bring the slides up, please? Good afternoon. It really is a privilege for me to address you this afternoon on what we believe is the real challenge of our times in residency training, and that is to give them sufficient autonomy so that they can mature, the residents can mature to be independent practitioners. And I'm going to share with you some introductory remarks, and given the fact that Dr. Combs won't be with us this afternoon, I'll spend about 3 minutes or 4 minutes during my talk covering what he had discussed and presented at a national meeting that we had convened, and I'll share with you some of the findings from the Hospital Association. He was a prominent leader in the American Hospital Association and now works full-time with the ACGME. So with that, let me get started. The key issues are certainly not new to anyone in this room. The first issue is the widespread concern nationally and in all surgical circles regarding the preparation of residents for independent practice or surgical practice. If you look at the first citation at the bottom of the slide, Dr. Bell, when he was at the American Board of Surgery, did a survey of program directors to get information on what they considered essential procedures, and then looked at the records from the case logs of the people who were sitting for the boards around 2005 and found big gaps in the experience that was expected by the PDs or thought to be essential by the PDs and what they were actually doing and what they had done during residency. And all of us as educators oftentimes say that really it's the innate ability sometimes that drives the ultimate level of competence. And numbers are not everything. But surely if the number is zero, that is an inadequate experience. And in many of those situations where there were essential procedures listed by the PDs, the most frequently cited number was zero through the record-keeping of the American Board of Surgery. So there is a problem. The second citation is the paper that was presented at the American Surgical in 2013, subsequently published in the Annals by Dr. Matar, who surveyed the fellowship program directors. And a lot of those fellowship directors complained that their incoming fellows were inadequately prepared technically. They could not proceed with the procedure independently. They did not have adequate diagnostic skills. And clearly, they were not able to take care of the patients the way one would expect. The second thing that is equally troubling, and that is drawn from the third citation, is the work that was done by Dr. Lina Napolitano when she was chair of our Board of Governors. And this was published in our journal, the Journal of the American College of Surgeons, in 2014. She did a survey of older surgeons who were defined as 45 years of age and higher than that. Now, we could debate whether those people should be listed as older surgeons or kind of young surgeons, but that was the cutoff. And people who were younger than that breakpoint, they were surveyed separately through the Young Surgeons or Young Fellows Association of the college. And lo and behold, the perceptions of these two groups, the senior surgeons who are accepting these new people, freshly minted graduates in their practices, and the perception of these young people were vastly different. Almost 60 to 70% of the senior people felt that people were reasonably trained or not adequately trained, but they were not happy with the training paradigm. And when you look at the young people who were joining the practices, more than 90% felt they were wonderfully trained and they were ready to assume their responsibilities. Then the senior people and the junior people were asked in the same survey, would a transition to practice program be helpful? And most of the senior people said yes. Only a few of the junior people said yes. And the duration, the ideal duration of that was also vastly different. The senior people were saying that it ought to be at least 1 year in length, whereas the junior people felt 3 to 6 months would be adequate. So there are differences in perceptions of these groups. And that underscores another problem. If we have out in the community a different perception of our graduating resident, on both sides, the people entering practice and the people accepting them, we have a problem that needs to be bridged. So with that, our division started looking at this very seriously. And this was a national meeting we convened in 2012 at the college's headquarters. And we had representatives from various boards, RRCs, now called RCs, but that time called RRCs, the PD organizations, professional societies and academies, and key stakeholders across the House of Surgery. They came to the college. There were 65 such people. We also included several stakeholders, such as representatives from the Joint Commission, from the American Hospital Association, from the military, from the GME side, and also from integrated healthcare systems like Kaiser. So we had a very, very broad talent pool there to give us some input about what was happening. And in that survey and in that dialogue that occurred and the consensus that was built, we came up with a clear definition of the problem and also recommendations, 4 at the resident level, 3 at the level of people entering practice. And all those 7 recommendations were then published in Surgery about a year and a half later. And that is the basis for a lot of what we are doing. Now, digressing a little bit to the site to cover what Dr. Combs had presented, as he won't be here at that meeting, they did a survey of the leaders of hospitals who were in charge of various systems or individual hospitals, both large teaching hospitals and community hospitals. And they asked them what they felt about the young people entering their systems as young practitioners in medicine and in surgery across the board, what they felt the needs were. Lo and behold, as would be expected, people said that individuals coming in were almost as prepared knowledge-wise as they would expect. So there were 2 lines, expectation and what the level was as they were entering the practice environment. But the huge gaps were in areas of systems-based practice, teamwork, practice-based learning, use of IT, use of resources, etc. So there is a huge perception, even at the level of the hospitals, that there is a gap that needs to be bridged, and we are really not preparing people enough. And certainly that ties in directly with the autonomy theme that we are talking about, because when people are going to be practicing alone or in groups, they need to have that level of exposure. We also have annually convened, more recently for the last 4 years, a national meeting with the same kinds of leaders from across the surgical domain, from the whole house of surgery, where we share experiences and focus on various topics. And this year's topic was autonomy, specific issues relating to autonomy. We talked about oversight and conditional independence, because clearly we cannot give total independence to the resident. We talked about the national mandates and issues that we are dealing with, the roles of systems, insurance carriers, faculty, because of all the regulations and restrictions, the role of the residents, and public perception and messaging. This is what Dr. Duvina was talking about. This is the focus of the committee, and you'll hear more about that during this panel, looking at both technical and non-technical skills, empowering the learners, faculty development systems, rules, regs, and patient education. So as I wrap up, let me share with you some of my thoughts about the challenges that exist. And I'm sure the speakers will address many of these, and hopefully we'll get your input at the end in the Q&A part and then the discussion to come up with some consensus that we can all work with. The first principle I believe that is sacrosanct is that we have to ensure delivery of the best surgical care while offering residents the opportunities to operate independently. Obviously, that is a balance, but we do need to safeguard the interests of the patients today so that we train the workforce for tomorrow, and we have to balance that. It's a very critical balance, which we have all worked with all our lives as teachers in surgery, and we need to strike that balance. Second is, I think we need realistic goals. It's okay and well and good to talk about lofty goals in terms of autonomy, but there are certain things that will not be possible given the reimbursement models, given the pressures on faculty, given the changing healthcare systems, and so on. The third is that we need a multifaceted ground swell of effort looking at different dimensions to address various complex issues. We need to link new approaches to addressing resident autonomy with other interventions aimed at the faculty, residents, and systems. Again, you'll hear more about that this afternoon. And we have to engage the stakeholders. There's no way we can address this without involving the hospitals, the insurers, the payers, and other stakeholders who are dictating a lot of what we do. And also we need to enlighten our department chairs so that they understand what it takes to have the faculty trained to provide more autonomy, because that requires a whole effort in faculty development that will take people away from some of the clinical work to come up to that level of expertise. And then on the other side, when people enter practice, we need to train our senior colleagues to support people coming out of residencies in the first couple of months to a couple of years even of practice. I remember when I was trained, it was during the dark ages of 100 plus unlimited hours that we spend in the hospital, and I was very fortunate in joining a full-time academic department where there were senior partners who were able to come down to the OR, look over my shoulder when I needed some guidance in the first couple of months. So I think even with the old models that we think about and dream about as being the good old days, we still had gaps when we entered practice, and clearly now some of the problems are more stark. And what we need to do is to create systems out in the practices where senior people, through a structured mechanism, can coach people and provide them greater and greater autonomy with some support as the junior partners join their practices. So that's all I have to say to begin the conversation, and I hope this kind of frames some of the issues, and thank you so much for your attention.